Next up, we hear from today's engineer, Joe Clement, who talks with Karen Gibson of Portland State University's Urban Studies program about her upcoming talk on race and gentrification in Portland.
Good morning. I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking today with Karen Gibson of Portland State University's Urban Studies and Planning Department. She specializes in housing and community development, Black urban history, and economic inequality. Tomorrow night, she'll be speaking at the Kennedy School, which is the McMiniman's on Northeast 33rd, just north of Killingsworth, as part of their Race Talks series. She'll be speaking about gentrification and the transformation of the African-American community in Portland. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Let's just start off by having you tell us a bit about what you're going to be talking about tomorrow night.
My talk is really going to be focused on the African-American community in Portland. And I take a long historical look at the community formation and change for this population, which was segregated and ghettoized and not given access to open housing markets by the Portland Realty Board and other institutions in the city, as well as private individuals. So I'm going to talk about the processes of segregation, ghettoization, disinvestment, reinvestment that resulted in the gentrification of the Albina District, which was the historic site of African Americans in Portland.
Could you outline for us just a bit of that history about where African Americans have lived in Portland and how that has changed?
Okay, well, for the African American population, at first they were confined to the area by the train station because prior to World War II, most lived here through work associated with the railroad as Pullman porters and with the hotel industry connected to that. So prior to 1940, African Americans made up less than 0.2% of the population of the city of Portland. And so World War II brought a mass of people, like the estimates are around 125,000 people came to Portland for war work in the early 40s, and about 25,000 African Americans came to work in the shipyards as well. And so that happened in the 40s. As you know, African Americans were segregated into Vanport and Giles Lake's housing projects and some joining the established community in Albina. But by 1950, many African Americans left the city because of the experience they had here. It was seen as the worst place on the West Coast for African Americans. More left Portland than left San Francisco or Seattle or L.A. So the population, I think, reached a peak at about 33,000 in 1990. But by 1940, even then, 60% of the black population lived in Albina. And by 1960, 80% of black people lived in the Albina district. So you're talking between like the Memorial Coliseum area up north through about seven or eight neighborhoods up to the Woodlawn neighborhood, with the northern border being Columbia Boulevard, and on the west, the border being the I-5 freeway, and on the east, about 15th Avenue. In 1960, 80% of the black population lived there. So some neighborhoods were 80% black, like Boise, in around 1960 or 70, okay, because of extreme institutionalized, systematic, racist housing discrimination.
How does that relate to redlining, which might be the first association people have to talk about racial discrimination and housing?
No. That is a misnomer. We're talking about segregation, residential segregation, where you can live. Redlining only pertains to mortgage lending. So we always had roughly half the population renting. They weren't necessarily redlined. They were segregated. So those are two different processes. Redlining pertains to mortgage lending. When an area is designated as off limits for bank loans, it is redlined.
Well, maybe we should clarify another key term. Just what is gentrification and what has it meant for the African-American population in Portland?
Gentrification, I like to distinguish between neighborhood revitalization and gentrification. I mean, a neighborhood can be revitalized, and therefore the property values may improve, the living conditions may improve. But when gentrification occurs, that means that one population, the gentry, meaning a middle or upper middle class population, being able to move in and effectively use their income and wealth to move out lower income people. And in the case of African Americans, it isn't just a case of lower income blacks being displaced, it's middle income blacks being forced to live in a particular area and then being unable to prevent their neighborhoods from changing in a way that pressures their community to disband. So it's an overlap, an intersection, an overlap, a compounding of race and class for African Americans. But you can have gentrification in all white neighborhoods. I mean, the term comes from Ruth Glass's study on London and the gentrification of white neighborhoods in London. So for African Americans, it is a confluence of race and class, because it didn't really matter whether you were black middle class. You still did not have choice of where to live, and you were still confined to the Albina neighborhood. I like to make the distinction between neighborhood revitalization and gentrification, and many African Americans lament the fact that their neighborhoods were disinvested, whether it was by, you know, amenities such as parks and stores and safety services, school services from the city. Their neighborhoods were disinvested, the building codes were not enforced. You had a huge amount of white flight in the 50s because of the racism that said that blacks and whites should not live together, and so suburbs were opened up for whites, so therefore they left as blacks moved in. So neighborhood change occurs in all neighborhoods, right? Neighborhoods change over time, but what you see today is this stark movement of African Americans out of neighborhoods, whether it be Harlem, you know, other large cities. People are being displaced from the central cities where they were confined in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, because there's a demand for that housing now in the central city, and whites, through white privilege, have better access to income, wealth, and property market.
As the controversy over a proposed Trader Joe's in North Portland earlier this year showed, there seemed to be a lot of different actors with stakes in urban development, from the communities themselves to private developers and even the academy in urban studies programs. What's important about who gets to say how our communities develop in cities?
Well, I mean, it's an important question about who gets to say what a community should look like. I mean, that is what urban planning is about. Is unfortunately, the history of urban planning is that, you know, with the urban renewal policies of the 50s, many communities were bulldozed without having a say. And planners today, we want to have communities to participate in deciding the future. And it is not just the private developers that are actors in this. It's also the public actors, such as the Portland Development Commission, the Planning Bureau, that are involved in implementing policies that have effects on neighborhoods. The problem with the Trader Joe's thing is that the Portland Development Commission has not been transparent or accountable in its plans and projects that it implements. I mean, that Trader Joe's story is a long one, and I don't think that the facts are clear about what happened. And I think citizens have a right to be informed about development processes, have a right to participate in those processes and in having a say about what their neighborhoods look like, whether you're low income, high income, whether you own property or not. We have a right to community. Now, of course, private property is sacred in this country, and that particular piece of land for Trader Joe's is owned by the city. And so that's public property. And so therefore, all people should have a say. But yes, the decisions should be made in an informed manner. So I agree that you have to have information, and the public should be educated about development processes in order to participate in a, you know, in a healthy way. I wrote about this when the Interstate Urban Renewal Project was first started. I looked at the public involvement process for that, and that Interstate Urban Renewal, that taxing district has played a major role in gentrification, and yet my analysis early on was that the public was really not being involved in a manner that was empowering to them, that they were really simply being placated by the city because of its requirement that it involve people. But I've long suggested that urban renewal decisions, that the city should actually put up money to allow residents to have technical advisors that can help them understand development, and so therefore they can weigh in an educated manner.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. I've been talking with Karen Gibson of the Portland State Urban Studies Program about Race Talks, a event happening at the Kennedy School this Tuesday. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Joe. London's